There's a particular kind of hope I sometimes have when I start a book. It's that maybe, just maybe, even though it goes against all my experiences to date, I might be starting the one book that gives me all the answers I'll ever need. It could happen. My Ginsu knife, my holy grail. Perhaps it might even be the book I frantically grab, unsure if I'll be interested or not, in the few seconds I have at an airport bookstore as I'm racing to the gate to board a flight. I do believe that my holy grail of books could be out there, and I intend to keep reading until I find it. Of course, I'll keep reading after I do, too, because I love to read. I also believe that the holy grail of books won't be the greatest book ever written. I am certain there isn't such a thing. I think it will simply be a book that speaks perfectly to me at the moment I most need it, and continues to speak to me for the rest of my life. So that's from the opening of Books for Living by Will Schwalbe, author of The End of Your Life, a book club. This is a book whose title actually tells us what is happening in between its covers. It's a book that talks about books for living. But I'm going to encourage you to do something even more startling. Once you've taken to heart the title, Books for Living, be sure to read the introduction to this book. Don't just listen to my brief excerpt from it. You know, those first few pages that most of us skim through on the way to the meat of the book itself. This introduction is full of insights, of thoughts, of ruminations that more than set the stage for the rest of the book. They connect us with the author and the hundreds, perhaps thousands of books the author and we have read already. Schwalbe notes so correctly that books help to ask and begin to answer the big questions in our lives, that holy grail moment, that Ginsu knife moment, no matter what our age. Indeed, he reminds us that those excursions in our mind that books inspire are especially potent at those times in our lives when we're most disrupted and lost at sea. He points in particular to our years in high school, those years of early adulthood, and during those times of stress or illness. More to the point, perhaps, it is that authors we read in solitary isolation or in big gulps of titles that bring us ideas and insights when we're ready to pursue them. He goes on to write about the longevity and the impact that the book itself has had. Through the many centuries we've had them, books, he writes, have developed a years-long, a decades-long, even centuries-long discussion among readers and thinkers and the writers who encourage us to keep reading on. We've all probably thought about that fleetingly. For instance, he asks, did J.K. Rowling perhaps develop some of Harry Potter from reading the 1850s Tom Brown School Days books? Perhaps. Perhaps not, but it's a question I think that those of us who read through our lives wonder. Okay, so when Plato, writing way back when Plato wrote, have something in common with what we're living today? Well, of course he did, because we're still reading him today. And what about all those people who have read Plato through the years, just to pull a name out of the hat? Aren't they engaging in a conversation with us as well, even into today? And, of course, into tomorrow. A little bit more, as our author writes. Books are uniquely suited to helping us change our relationship to the rhythms and habits of daily life in this world of endless connectivity. We can't interrupt books. We can only interrupt ourselves while reading them. Books are the expression of an individual or a group of individuals, not of a hive mind or of collective consciousness. They speak to us thoughtfully, one at a time. They demand our attention, and they demand that we briefly put aside our own beliefs and prejudices and listen to someone else's. You can rant against a book, scribble in the margin, or even chuck it out the window. Still, you won't change the words on the page. The technology of a book is genius. The order of the words is fixed, whether on the page or on screen, but the speed at which you read them is entirely up to you. Sure, this allows you to skip ahead and jump around, but it also allows you to slow down, to savor, to ponder. And to imagine that that's been going on for many, many years, sometimes centuries, gives us something to think about. Our author muses with us about how books connect us to one another, therefore, and asks whether that oft-uttered question, "What are you reading?" can bring together passengers on a train. It can prompt an hours-long discussion at a dinner party, and it can bring zest and anticipation to a phone discussion between a grandmother and her grandson, though they may live far away from each other. And he then goes into an anecdote of how a grandmother was kind of befuddled by her grandson's rather short answers over the phone. She asked him one day what he's reading. He said, "The Hunger Games." She delved into it, and according to our author, it has given those two folks, the far-off distance between the grandmother and the grandson, something to talk about in depth every time they chat over the phone. "What are you reading?" was the start of that hopefully lifelong conversation between the two of them. Now into the meat of the book itself. Have you read some of these books yourself? No doubt you have. I admit that not all the titles that our author tells us about in Books for Living are books that are reading buddies of mine. But after reading a couple of chapters about the books I had already read, I found the author's wisdom and fancy intersected more than a little with mine. We were kindred readers in many ways, and that gave the entire book credence to me, whether I had read the particular title under discussion or not. Take a look at the books that he suggests to our eyes and our minds, books that he says will be important to us if we bother to pick them up and go through them. We quickly find that our author is not stuck on any one period of history or theme or type of author. He roves over time and over genres, over bestsellers, over great literature, and over just popular books, all the while weaving his own thoughts and reasons for loving the 26 books he writes about in this page-turner of a book. As one book leads to another, I found our author inviting us to begin our own list of "glad I read that book" and think and write about our own reasons for developing the list we do during the course of our lives. Not a bad project at any age. Give you a couple of examples. We venture into Song of Solomon, Toni Morrison's tale of racism in America, that leads our author to muse as well about the beauty of winnowing one's book collection down to 100 titles, even as our days winnow down to a perilous few. You'll have to read the chapter in full to understand the smoothly glided connection, but a smoothly glided connection it is. He talks about "Death Be Not Proud," and he talks about "The Odyssey," a book that is Greek in presentation, perhaps even more ancient in its origin. And our author uses this age-old tale of one man's adventures, as he finds his way home, as a means to talk with us about mediocrity, of all things, how being average, and certainly, he writes, Odysseus was an average man in his age of so many ways, about how being average is okay and perhaps something a lot of us don't give enough credence to in our lives. He quotes not only from The Odyssey, but from British essayist G.K. Chesterton, who, he reminds us, wrote, "If a thing is worth doing, it's worth doing badly." Our author goes on to tell us, sure, it may be worth more done well, but if a thing is worth doing, it's worth doing no matter how well or badly you do it. It's just plain worth doing. When we denigrate mediocrity, we discourage ourselves and others for trying new things. It would be great to be a great painter, but it's also great just to paint, or sing, or throw pots, or knit scarves, or play chess. That doesn't mean, though, he continues, we should lower our standards. In fact, it's partly this unwarranted horror of mediocrity that causes us to call things great that are merely good or fine. There are plenty of good slices of pizza to be had in Greenwich Village that are neither the best nor the worst slices in New York City. We don't have to pretend they are something more than tasty and filling to enjoy them. We might even want to try to make our own mediocre pizza from time to time. And as for Odysseus, even he would have to admit that he didn't do a great job of getting home. Sure, he was a clever fellow, but an arrogant one too, a boaster, a troublemaker. Others managed to come home right after the war chronicled in the Iliad. It took Odysseus 10 years. He was held captive. He dawdled. He got lost. He was caught in storms, and he almost gave up his quest to live with Circe, an enchantress, who also happened to be an excellent cook. But he does eventually make it back, with help from the gods, to Ithaca, where life is in massive disarray. The return is a solid C-level performance. Far from an A, sure, but by no means a failure. In sum, I do hope you'll make time for Book of Living on your I'm going to read this book stack of books, and perhaps some of the titles he covers: The Importance of Living, Stuart Little, The Girl on the Train, Giovanni's Room, David Copperfield, Reading Lolita in Tehran, More, More, Said the Baby, A Journey Around My Room, What the Living Do. Perhaps some of those are on your I'm going to read that book someday too. Books for Living may just give you some insights as to why reading one of those titles might be a good thing to kind of push up on your agenda. So no, this is not a book about the greatest books ever written. So it's not setting out to tax your brain or your stamina. It is a book that encourages us to think about and talk about those books we treasure as guideposts in our lives. And I think we can all happily remember one or two or maybe even a dozen of those. As our author tells us in his chapter entitled A Final Word, how we live is no trivial matter. Racing around in a state of agitation and greed and envy isn't just wasting our lives, it's a symbol of much that is wrong with our world. And reading all different kinds of books is not simply reading all different kinds of books. It's a way of becoming more fully human and more humane. When I read, I'm reminded to be more thoughtful about how I approach each day. And that's not just important for living. It's the least I can do for the dead. I read to live. I read for life. Books for Living, Will Swalby. It's a great book if you're interested in pursuing why we read and perhaps why it's important that we read. It's available at all those fine emporiums of fine reading, our public libraries, and certainly at the West Lafayette Public Library.